Our liberties we prize, and our rights we will maintain. This is Iowa Civil Rights History Podcast, where we tell stories about the contribution Iowans and the state of Iowa has made to advance the civil rights movement. Past stories are being told, present actions will be highlighted, and preparation for the future will be discussed. Here is your host, Eric Anyange.
Welcome to the Iowa Civil Rights History Podcast. My guest today is Dr. David Broadnax, best known by his students as Dr. B. He's a history professor at Trinity Christian College in Chicago, Illinois. He holds a Bachelor of History from Wesleyan University, Master's and PhD in History from Northwestern University. To top it off, he holds a law degree from University of Iowa. Our conversation today will be on the selective topics of Black history in the state of Iowa in the 19th century. Dr. B, welcome to the show.
Thank you. We've been working on trying to schedule this for a while.
I know.
And it's good to, we finally got the chance to do it. So,
Bachelor from Wesley?
From Illinois Wesleyan. Mm-hmm.
In history. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you went to the law school.
Yep, where we are now.
Yep.
College of Law.
College of Law. And then you went back to, for your master's.
Master's and PhD from Northwestern University.
Northwestern University, both in history.
Yes.
And I was sitting there in my mind, I'm like, man, how much history can you study? So where grew up?
It's an interesting question. I was born in Chicago. I grew up mostly there. I also spent part of my childhood in Tuskegee, Alabama.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's where my grandmother is from, my family on her side. Spent some of my childhood in West Tennessee also, which is where my grandfather is from. But, went to school in Chicago and all that. So kind of I claim Chicago and Alabama both as home.
Okay.
And Iowa has, people told me I'm an adopted Iowan now.
How much of you growing up in Alabama had a lot of influence on you studying history?
I would say a lot. I mean, and not just Alabama, but Tuskegee. And my grandmother was an alum of Tuskegee University and was on the alumni board. So I grew up on that campus in a sense. And, you're in the place where Booker T. Washington was the president, right?
Yeah.
Where George, my grandmother knew George Washington Carver.
Oh, really?
Because he was friends with my great-grandparents. So he used to come over for dinner.
Oh, wow.
You grew up hearing stories like that. And, you got the Tuskegee Airmen and just sort of being in the place where so many things happened. But also, being in Chicago, one of the people who was a great mentor to me growing up, grew up in Chicago back in the 1910s, and told me about like the 1919 Chicago race riot. I had other elders in Chicago who knew about that history going back to the 1910s, 20s, 30s. So just growing up around you could say, history is everywhere, right? No matter where you go, important things happen there. But growing up around so much Black history in particular.
Now you're a professor at Trinity Christian College in Chicago, Illinois. How long have you been teaching? Almost 19 years?
This is my 19th year, yes.
Oh, wow. What is the relationship between law and history? I'm trying to think back when you decided to go to law school. After you studied history, what does that merge look like?
Well, I have two thoughts there. One is the story of how that happened. I was a history major in college, like you said. I wanted to be a history professor. That was, my idea as a history major as an undergrad. Then I took a class in constitutional law, and I was fascinated by it. And I thought, maybe I should want to be a law professor. To be perfectly honest, I found how much money law professors make compared with how much history professors make. And I thought, well, now I really want to be a law professor, right? This is an important decision in terms of next steps because it means you're either going to go to law school or you're going to go to grad school. So I came to law school, and in my first semester, I learned a lot, but it also became clear to me that I did not actually want to teach the law full time. My first thought was the right thought, that what I actually wanted to do was be a history professor. But I decided to finish the law degree anyway. It's only 3 years. And I thought, I could teach legal history, once I finished a PhD, right? There's so much about the law that fascinates me. I just don't want to teach these kinds of classes like full time. And so I went on, got the PhD, and I've been teaching ever since. You asked about the connection between the history and the law. I mean, they're so closely related. In terms of history, no matter what aspect of history you're teaching, it's impossible to understand it without understanding the role that the law plays. Because the law governs everything. You and me drive into the law school today. There's speed signs, right? This is how fast you can go. That's the law, right? You know, we're in this building. You know, how many, you know, legal decisions had to be made in order for this building to be constructed? The law governs everything. In terms of African-American history, you know, the law has been our enemy and our friend. We've used it as a shield. We've used it as a weapon. Sometimes it's been used as a weapon against us, yep. Right? We have always had a very complicated relationship with the American legal system.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also always looked at it as, if we can get this on our side, then we can make things better.
God and history are inseparable. Hmm. Talk to me.
Well, I mean, I am a Christian, and I teach at a Christian university. When you teach at a Christian university, then you can sort of more explicitly talk about certain things. And so what I don't do is, you know, get up there. You know, there's sort of lazy faith-based history, which is to say everything happened because it was God's will. Okay, well, even if you believe that, what are the process? What are the human processes that caused it to come out the way that it did?
Yeah.
Right? So I don't just do that. You know, for me, as a Christian, I see God's purpose playing out, you know, through history, right? You know, and people, you know, struggle against that in some ways. And so that's why you see some of the bad things that happen in history. But I also think about, historically speaking, the way that people's faith has motivated them.
Right? Yeah,
I mean,
that's
we could,
true.
You know, we could be here for 10 hours talking about all of the people in Black American history whose faith motivated them to try to make things better. I mean, yeah. you start with Dr. King if you want to,
yep.
And go all, you know, you talk about like Reverend William Barber today. And I mean, it's going throughout history.
And also people's faith made them do bad things.
That is true. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, done things against, you know, the Black race in a lot of ways, right? So I was just talking about this with my African-American history class, right? The ways that people try to twist Christianity, tried to use Paul's letters, for instance, to try to justify slavery and, you know, completely made up the whole, you know, like racialized the curse of Ham story, right? Where you've got this story that's got nothing to do with race. And then like, oh, well, we're going to say this is where Black people came from, because this is why you all are destined to be enslaved, right, by us, right? And so, yeah, it's, you know, the people who bound Black churches during the Civil Rights Movement would have identified as Christians, right? So they're attacking a Christian institution because they identify as Christians, right? I mean, for me, it's partly, like I said, it's about understanding the role that religion has played in history, but also thinking about, what do I, as a Christian, think about all this stuff, right? And, you know, I have students who come from every background. I have Muslim students, Jewish students. You know, I have students of no faith background whatsoever. I have some atheist students, right? And so it's not a situation where, like, okay, now I'm going to make you all believe what I believe, make you all see things the way that I see them, right? Not with faith, not with anything, but it's sort of like we're at least going to explore what these issues are. I remember reading, I quote this often, and I can't remember the name of the book, but it's a book about the Civil Rights Movement, and there's a white teenager in the South who's sort of like getting his eyes open to the way things really are, and he's arguing with his mom, right, who is just like stone cold, racist, segregationist, and he asks her, Mom, what do you think Jesus would do if he was here right now in Mississippi? And she says, I know what Jesus would do, and he would be wrong. Right.
Is that the place where you stop? Because you can't save that person?
Well, I mean, that's up to each individual, right? It's, there are some people, you know, everybody's not put, everybody doesn't have the same, like, purpose, right?
Yeah.
And so there are some people who make it their mission to say, now I'm going even harder on you, right? Now I'm going to work on you even more. Like, my job is to go for the people who are, whose beliefs are just so ossified, who seem so firm in their prejudice, and I'm going to just try to, you know, I'm going to love on you, I'm going to listen to all the horrible things you say, and then I'm hopefully going to change your mind.
Yeah.
And then there are other people who say, I just can't, right? I don't have the bandwidth for that, you know, when that other person has worked on you a little bit and you're a little bit more open-minded, then come talk to me, you know, and for many of my students, I'm the first, you know, not just first Black professor, but first Black educator they've ever had. And even for my students who are, you know, who are Black, who are from the South Side, the Chicago, the West Side, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm often the first Black male educator they've ever had, right?
So, oh, wow.
So it's just like I'm going to do what I do. And then hopefully that alone, you know, and when you have your questions, you know, I'm going to answer your questions. I'm going to answer them. You know, I'm not going to say, well, you know, just shut up. I'm sick of this. Or, yeah. you know, you're just a bigot or whatever. I'm going to answer your questions.
Right? Yeah.
So I'm going to refute the narrative out there that college is where, you know, woke professors just impose their viewpoint
yep.
on students.
They brainwash just, our
right,
kids.
Yeah. Brainwash our kids, right, and just try to shut down all debate. And like, okay, you have some thoughts? Let's hear it. Right?
Mm.
So.
Oh, nice.
You know, and I know that there's been some students who have told me that was eye-opening for them, right?
Oh,
and,
really?
And it's not going to work on everybody. But,
that's true.
You know.
What is your thought on Constitution?
Iowa, United States?
United States in general.
Hmm. That is a good question. I mean, it was everything I'm thinking about this historically. So I'm thinking about Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison, two of the giants of abolitionism, fundamentally disagreed on this, right? William Lloyd Garrison said that the Constitution was a covenant with hell. And he would burn it in public. He'd hold up a copy of it and say, this is a covenant with hell, and he'd burn it because it protected slavery. You know, it allowed Southerners to import more slaves for the first 21 years of the country, right? So it did, in fact, protect slavery. Frederick Douglass looked at it and said, but it could be more than that. Right now, it is not helping us. But the principles of the Constitution, what if we can get those on our side? And so I think it's both. I think that you think about the 14th Amendment, for instance, right?
Yeah.
Back when it's passed and it says, like, all people will have equal protection under the law, regardless of other factors, right? We're going to create federal citizenship for these 4 million former slaves. That is a good thing. Now, once you have people who start using that as a tool to protect corporations, using that as a weapon, you know, even people today saying, well, the 14th Amendment, you know, was race neutral. How can you say the 14th Amendment is race neutral? It was meant to help 4 million former slaves.
Yeah.
They were all Black.
Black, yep.
Right, so.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, they had a thought that the people who would be in charge of the government, that these would be reasonable people, that these would be people who had the best interests of the country in mind, that they would not act purely out of self-interest. Now, they were also somewhat pessimistic about human nature, right? That's why they had the checks and balances. So just in case we do get, you know, a corrupt, wicked president, you know, they can't just do whatever they want. Right, because we have these other branches right now. So I think that's part of the reason why it's been harder to find common ground.
What is the way forward?
Ooh, if I knew I could publish a book and you know, buy an island off the coast of Louisiana, retire, and me and my girlfriend could just eat beignets all day, right?
Because, I mean, we got to find a solution somehow,
right.
Some way.
This is self-serving, but I think education is part of it.
Okay.
You know, I think that. And even bigger than just formal education, but we have to, the current, I call it an epistemological crisis, which is just my fancy way of saying my five least favorite words in the English language right now are, I did my own research.
Oh.
Right, where there's people who, you know, not that anyone should ever just sort of blindly follow expertise or blindly follow somebody with a degree. There's folks who will say, I'll give you an example. You know, this was like the early 2010s, I think, and you know, a student complained about some class policy, and she thought that I wasn't being a good professor. She said that.
Yeah.
And I told her, well, here's what it means to be a professor. And she wrote back and said, why Google professor, and here's what it means. So you are telling a professor what it means to be a professor because you hit the Google button. Like, okay, epistemological crisis, right? So I think the part of it is that we just have to find some kind of way to push back against this thing of, I can go online and find whatever information I want. And you can find whatever you want.
Yeah.
You go looking for something, you know, you can find it.
Doesn't mean it's true.
Right. It doesn't mean it's true, but you like, well, I found it, so it must be true. Well, what that really means is that you want it to be true. One of my favorite songs of all time, right, you know, The Boxer by Simon and Garfunkel. The man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. And they said that before the internet. I think that what's changed is that now it's easier to hear what you want to hear and disregard the rest. Yeah. Because whatever you want to find, you can Google it. And then you just say, well, you know, you got your facts and your degrees and all that and your expertise, but I found this here website. So I think that we have to figure out how to push back against that.
Mm.
You know, and the other thing I'd say is people have to figure out, have to learn, in some ways relearn, but how to see their neighbor as theirself. I tell my students sometimes, right, like I teach students from all kinds of different backgrounds, but no matter who you are and where you come from, I can see something in you that reminds you of me.
That's how evil happens. Because the moment you start seeing your fellow citizen as less than human, less than you.
Yeah. Then you can justify anything. Yeah,
you can justify violence.
Right. Oh, yeah. Those aren't people.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, so, yeah.
Or they're not as human as we are. Right. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. So if people can do that more, it becomes a lot harder to do some of the things that people do to each other now. Yeah. Right?
Let's get to Iowa. One of your areas that you are, I would say you're expert, is the 19th century.
Yeah, that's where I focus. Black.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's your main focus. Why 19th century?
It's a good question. I guess the answer to that is what led me to this research in the first place.
Oh, so, yeah.
I mean, the building that we are in actually helped lead me to this research. So, I should say also, you know, we're here in Iowa City because I taught a class here earlier today, and so we're in the media room. So I want to give a shout out to the Iowa College of Law for letting us use this space. But
yeah, before you jump into that, how often do you usually come and teach here?
I've been doing this since 2014 is when I first started. So okay. There's a class that it's sort of like intro to legal reasoning for the first year law student. And it used to be that they would do this like in August, right before the regular semester started, right? So from 2014 to 2019, I would come one day every August and I would teach my class on legal history. And then, of course, 2020, you know, yeah. Everything changed, yeah. Right? So that year I did it remotely. And in 21 and 22, they kind of went in a different direction, so I didn't do it. But then this year, they asked me to come back. But they've changed the format, so now instead of it all being in the first week before the semester starts, they kind of spread it out throughout the semester.
Oh, okay.
So that's why I'm here today.
Okay, okay.
But so, you know, I have no family background in Iowa, right? Mm. I mean, I have people here now who are like family to me, but when I came here as a law student, I had one cousin who went to Clark College up in Dubuque, but aside from that, I had no connection to the state. A few things happened. I mean, one of them is that you walk into the building and you see the plaque there that's got, you know, three people on it. And it's the first ever graduate of the law school who is a white man. It's the first ever woman graduate who's a white woman. And it's the first ever black graduate who is Alexander. For the simple purpose of clarity, I'll call him Alexander Clark Jr.
Okay.
Technically, he's not junior because they have different middle names, but whatever. He's Clark
okay.
Jr. So me coming in here, like, well, let me learn more about this Alexander Clark, right? The other thing that happened, though, is I just happened to one night walk past Bethel AME, the black church, mm-hmm. right? You know, kind of on the out. Well, I guess it's not the outskirts of town anymore, but it was then. And I'm just going down the street, and I see Bethel AME founded 1868, I think it was. And, like, there was a black church in Iowa City in 1868. And at that exact moment, somebody came walking out. And it wasn't Sunday morning. But somebody comes walking out and says, excuse me, there was a black church here since 1868? He said, yes, brother, you should come tomorrow. So I did, you know, and that also got me interested. Now, this is when I'm thinking I'm going to go to grad school, but I'm going to study Southern history. That's what I had focused on as an undergrad, right? And even when I started grad school, you know, I initially was doing black Southern history. My master's dissertation is about Alabama. I thought that that was what I was going to do. But I just sort of kept thinking about all this black history, this 19th century black history in Iowa that I knew nothing about. And as far as I know, like, nobody else really knew much about either. And just thinking, maybe this is where I fit in. Maybe this is what I should do, is learn more about this and then see what there is to learn, see what this means. Like, and the more I learned, the more I got drawn in, right? You know, when you find out that Iowa became the first state after the Civil War where black men got the right to vote. Iowa, yeah. Right? Not one of, like, the liberal New England states, not a Midwestern state with a larger black population, Iowa. You find out that Iowa becomes the first state to desegregate the public schools, right, after the war with the Clark case. First state to say, you cannot discriminate on common carriers like steamboats and trains, 1873. You know, that Iowa had a black Civil War regiment. And like everything I learned, I'm like, the question is why? How? Right. So I just ended up going in that direction. In terms of the 19th century, why there? Maybe it's because this is where, you know, where these specific things happen. I mean, I've always been interested in 19th century history. You know, I wonder, not to like psychoanalyze myself, but, you know, two of the people who helped raise me were my great grandmothers.
Right? Okay.
One died when I was 11, the other died when I was 14. Right. But we're both like just really important in my, you know, my childhood. Right. And I love them dearly. You know, it was, I remember being very young and being fascinated by the fact that I knew people who were born in a different century than me. They're not even from this century, right? And but then also, they were the children of former slaves.
Mm.
I think part of what drew me to the 19th century is I knew these two people who were from that time and were born in that time, but it's like they're my direct connection to that. Mm. So I think that maybe even more so than, in a sense, it was almost like, I don't know anybody who actually remembers the 1800s,
okay.
So I want to learn more about it that way.
Since we are at the college, and let's talk about Iowa education.
Mm-hmm.
How was the black education in Iowa look like before 1868?
It's a good question. So Iowa becomes a separate territory in 1839, mm-hmm. right? And so then you have the first territorial legislature. One of the first things they did was pass an education law, which said that they passed the territorial constitution, which doesn't say anything about race when it comes to education. Now, the first territorial constitution does say that voting is restricted to white men, and you know only white men can vote, only white men can serve in the state militia, which I'll explain. That's what they used to call the equivalent of like the National Guard today. Only white men can serve in the state House of Representatives. Education piece didn't say anything about race, but they very immediately passed a law, the Act to Regulate Blacks and Mulattoes is what they called it. They put blacks and mulattoes because they wanted to make it clear being of mixed ancestry does not exclude you. Yeah, from the very beginning of the territorial law legislature, you've got this law saying the public schools are for white children only. So I was just talking to the law students about this earlier today. It wasn't even that there were black schools and white schools. They were only white schools.
White school.
Right. Mm. Like black children were completely barred from education. Now, that being said, black parents still had to pay the tax to support the schools. You got to pay a tax to support schools that your children are legally barred from. So that's how it was. Now, did any black children attend school? A few did. So there's a few who lived in small towns, especially in southeastern and southwestern Iowa, that had like a large Quaker presence. And so there were white Quakers who provided private education to some of the black kids who lived there, right? So those kids were receiving some education. In terms of formal institutions, there were two black schools in the entire state. One of them was the school run out of Bethel AME Church in Muscatine, Iowa, right? The school that the Clarks helped to found, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a private school. The other one, there's a group up in northeast Iowa in Fayette County. They're originally from North Carolina. It's kind of an extended family. They're of mixed ancestry, and they kind of made their way from North Carolina in the 1830s and then sort of settled, you know, Indiana, then Illinois. And then finally, about 50 of them bought land in Fayette County, Iowa. They were banned from going to the public school, but there were enough of them that they were basically able to found their own church and run their own school out of that. Those were the only two black schools that I'm aware of in the entire state before 1857.
Do we know what the population was? The kids who needed to be educated?
The overall school age population?
Yeah.
We have that from the census. Now, there's okay. problems with looking, you know, using the census. It always overlooks people. And especially with African Americans before the Civil War in the North, it was especially, you know, there were a lot of black people who didn't get included because a lot of blacks in the North were, you know, fugitive slaves. And so these are folks who might not necessarily want to be counted on the census, right? And then there were also going to be census takers who couldn't be bothered. Like, I don't need to go count those black people, right? But if you take that grain of salt with it, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me now, there were hundreds of school-age black children around the state, but only a handful of them, the census has a question that says, you know, is this child in school? And only a handful of them were, right? So that would have been the few in Muscatine, the few in Fayette County, and then some who were, like I said, receiving that like kind of private Quaker tutelage in different places, right?
Wow.
And then in the early 1850s, the Iowa legislature actually changed that policy and said black parents are exempted from school tax because black parents protested and said, well, why is it that we got to pay this tax, but our children can't even go to school? And the legislature said, you know what? You're right. So you don't have to pay the tax anymore. And black parents were basically saying, that's not what we wanted, right? We wanted our children to be able to go to school.
But
so they got rid of that. Then, though, in 1857, Iowa writes a new state constitution, and that's when the public schools got opened up to all children, regardless of race. And that's in itself, I was telling the law students about this morning, there's this massive text called Debates of the 1857 Constitutional Convention. It's over 1,000 pages long. They did not call a new state constitution to discuss matters of race, but there were some of the white delegates who came from places like Mount Pleasant, from like, you know, the Davenport area, from Muscatine, who said, let's try to make a more egalitarian constitution. And so they, you know, when the subject of schools came up, some of them said, how about we, you know, admit black children to the school, right? And the more conservative delegates were just, you know, weren't having it. You know, same thing with voting. So they ended up spending a whole lot of time on these issues. What they finally decided was they would write a constitution that says that the public schools are open to all the youth of the state. You know, so no longer banning black children from attending public school. After the constitution is ratified, the state legislature passed a law saying the schools will be segregated unless every single white parent in a school district agrees to have it be integrated. So like if this is, you know, let's say Mason City, where you're from, Mason City is going to have segregated schools unless every single white parent in Mason City says, I agree to the schools being integrated.
Which is impossible.
Which is impossible, right? So you're never going to get 100% consent. That's the law that they passed, right?
Yeah.
But now at least you have segregated schools.
Yeah.
Right? So
something
now,
is better than nothing.
Right. So now Muscatine School Board starts giving a small amount of tax dollars to the church school in Muscatine. You get the creation of a few black schools, you know, in Davenport, for instance.
Oh, so the school start giving money to AME?
Right.
Church, okay, to run their own school?
Right.
Okay.
So it ends up being, you know, the lines back then between sort of public and private or, you know, like issues of separation of church and state, a lot blurrier than they are now, right? So they said, okay, well, we're sure as heck not going to admit these black kids to the white schools, to the white public schools. We're going to say that this is now a quasi-public school, and so we're going to give you some funding. Not a lot. You know, it's as you see from the Clark case, the school was still woefully underfunded. But that is a big change. So that's 1857. Then, of course, a few years later, you got the Civil War. Black population almost quintuples during the Civil War. Goes from around 1,000 to almost 6,000, right? Well, over 5,000, right?
Yeah.
So I guess I should say it almost sextuples during the war. And so now you have black schools, you know, in whole lots of places that didn't have them.
But the black population increased?
Oh, yeah. If you go by overall numbers, it's still small. If you go by how much it's increased, I mean, again, going from 1,000 to like around 5,700 in about 5 years, it's huge. I mean,
where all these black people came from?
You know, when the Civil War starts, you know, the fugitivism, you know, increases massively. So there's a whole lot of enslaved Southern blacks who like come to the north, especially from Missouri and Kentucky, you know, for geographic reasons.
Yeah.
Right? It makes sense that they would be, you know, that those would be the two states that would send the most to Iowa.
Okay.
There's some white Iowan soldiers who are down south. You know, they meet, you know, freed folk and they say, why don't you go up to Iowa and work on the family farm, right? You know, because, you know, my kinfolk, while I'm down here fighting, like, I'm not up working on the farm, so my family needs some help. So I'll send you up there, and then you can work for us, right? You know, or when they left the service, then they'd bring these people with them, right? But it was mainly black initiative. It was mainly a whole lot of black Kentuckians and Missourians and people from other states, too, but especially those two states who are coming north, which is why so many of them end up in Keokuk, right?
Yeah.
In Mount Pleasant, in Clarinda. What do all these things have in common? These are all in southern Iowa, right? So crossing the state line and then settling there, you know, Davenport gets a lot. This is when Des Moines gets its first like significant black population, right? So
okay, and it's crazy when you think back then, is it even the means of communication was crazy?
Yeah, it's word of mouth.
Yeah,
right. And of course, I mean, black Missourians and Kentuckians in particular, and from other states, had been fleeing from slavery and coming to Iowa for decades before the war.
Yeah.
What happens is that now that just increases exponentially, right? Mm. So like I said, now you've got a whole bunch of new black schools. But the situation in 1867 when Susan Clark gets turned away from grammar school number 2 in Muscatine, Iowa, situation is there's now publicly run black schools, you know, many of them all over the state, being run separately because the 1857 Constitution says that you have to do that.
Now we get to 1867, Alexander Clark and Susan Clark case. Alexander Clark, just like probably most of black parents in Iowa, they say, yeah, our kids get educated in these black schools, but not really.
Yeah.
We need to do something about it. In just a little bit summary, how that case came about, because I know I already discussed this case, but I'm always fascinated.
Right,
by it.
Right. And that was, I did listen to that, and you know, my friend Russ did a phenomenal job of sort of going through the history of that. So as I was listening to it, I was thinking, okay, what, you know, if you're going to ask me about Clark, then what are some angles that I can take?
So add it up, yeah.
So, right, because first of all, you know, he did a great job, so I don't need to, you know, reinvent the wheel. But
yeah.
Also, you know, your listeners don't need to hear the same thing twice. So I think what I would do is focus more on the dilemma that parents like Alexander and Catherine Clark faced. Right?
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, they're a prosperous family. You know, they have the means to send their children to school. And, you know, this is a time when a lot of children dropped out of school before they even got to the eighth grade.
Oh, really?
Right. And certainly not going to high school, right?
Why was the high dropout rate?
People needed their kids to start working.
Oh.
Right. And especially people from lower income backgrounds, right?
Okay.
Which would have been the majority of black Iowans, right?
Yeah.
You know, the Clarks are quite prosperous. So for them, we want our daughter to go to high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
We want all our children to go to high school. We have bigger dreams for them, right?
Yeah.
And we have the means to help them achieve that. So the dilemma that black parents face, and this is not just with education, and this is not just with Iowa in the 1860s, but this is kind of like a broader question of black life, just for even to the present day, which is integrating predominantly white spaces versus supporting and amplifying black spaces, right? So, you know, and the question is, okay, we've got this black school. It employs a black teacher, right? This is a space for our children. They're not being racially mistreated, right? They're being affirmed. They have this role model. Sarah Davidson was her name. Like, they have this person in front of the room who, like, you know, they can, you know, look up to and try to emulate. This is our space, right?
Yeah.
It may be underfunded. It may not be the best school, but it's ours.
Yeah.
If we send our kids into the white schools, they're not going to have black teachers anymore because nobody's going to hire black teachers. You know, there's going to be very little chance that they're going to learn an affirming curriculum. Mm. They're probably going to face abuse from their fellow students and possibly from teachers as well. And so what do we want to do here, right? And, you know, this is an issue even to this day. I mean, in terms of, you know, I think about the fact that the Negro Leagues, within 10 years of Jackie Robinson integrating, you know, playing first base for Brooklyn Dodgers, the Negro Leagues are gone.
Yeah.
Black colleges, still going strong. It's not just a matter of, well, they won't let us into this white space, so we'll form our own black space. It's also, we want this to be a space that is affirming and that, like, is culturally relevant. But for the Clark family, you know, like I said, they've got bigger dreams for young Susan. So part of the basis for the lawsuit is they wanted her to go to high school. High school, Muscatine High School had a qualifying exam. Back then, you could teach K-12 with a high school diploma. Right. And also in Iowa, like, high school, you know, required tuition. The state of Iowa paid for you to go to eighth grade, up to eighth grade for free. High school was tuition. It was almost like colleges now, right? Mm-hmm. They wanted her to go to high school, but they said this, you know, black school in Muscatine is not going to prepare her, right? You know, she's not going to be able to pass the entrance exam, right? There's an English class we want her to take that the black school doesn't offer. Now, if you're a black parent and you're thinking, you know, I would love for my kid to be able to rise to the top, but I just need for them to learn how to read and write and be able to sort of navigate themselves through the world, you know, and they're going to leave school when they're like, you know, 11, 12 years old so that they can like start working, then, you know, the black school's fine.
It's fine, yeah.
Right. And if it's like, I would like my kids to go to school further than that, but I can't pay this high school tuition, right? Mm-hmm. So my, you know, I cannot afford to, number one, have my child not making money, and number two, not only are they not making money, but they're costing money because now I'm paying for them to go to high school, right? Yeah. So there's going to be some black parents who are going to say, I may have big dreams for my kid, but I also know the reality.
Yeah.
Clarks have the ability to sort of do something about that. So, but this ends up being a dilemma throughout the state in terms of what do we want for our kids, right? Yeah.
Do we know what her mom was thinking? Because her mom is kind of silenced in the history a little
That's unfortunate, right? Yeah. So, yeah, this is... you know, even with black life, you know, the primary source is privilege, you know, men over women and children, right?
So
we know very little about what Catherine Clark thought about different things, right?
Yeah.
She shows up in historical record. Once she gets married, she shows up basically like, you know.
As Mrs. Clark.
As Mrs. Clark, right?
And
in terms of like what, you know, like for instance, Alexander brings a lawsuit. There's no question that they would have had to agree on that. There's no way that Alexander Clark's going to. So I'm going to bring this lawsuit, and his wife has no say in that, no voice in that. So I'm sure that they were partners in that decision.
Even to send the Susan to that school.
Exactly, right. But we don't have anything in her voice on that. So, and then, you know, she doesn't live a whole lot longer after the Clark case. She dies in, I think, the early 1880s. So, yeah, I wish that there were that those voices could be uncovered.
What is your thought on Alexander Clark as a man and as a leader?
Yeah, I mean, he's born free because his mother was free, but his father was enslaved. He moves to Cincinnati, Ohio as a teenager, and he you know, that's where he learns the barbering trade. He leaves there when he's 16 years old and 15 years old in 1841. We don't know for certain why he left, but there's also a race riot in Cincinnati in 1841. Now, when we think of race riots today, we think of, you know, things like Watts in 1965 or, you know, L.A. and, you know, after the Rodney King verdict. But race riot used to mean, you know, angry white folks going into black neighborhoods and destroying everything and trying to kill everybody in sight. Right. Like New York in 1863. Right. Like the South Side of Chicago in 1919. And so this happened three times over a 10-year period in Cincinnati. Cincinnati had the Midwest's largest black population, you know, churches, schools, you know, political activists, entrepreneurs, like Alexander Clark's uncle. This was like a prosperous, growing black community. And three times, basically, like pro-slavery Ohioans joined with Kentuckians, and they went into the black, I mean, I think we could use the word pogrom here, right? You know, they went into these communities and destroyed property and tried and beat and tried to kill people, right? Mm. And so Clark leaves in 1841. Now, did he leave because of the riot? We don't know for certain. But I don't think it was a coincidence. And that's when he makes his way to Muscatine. He's a teenager. And he starts barbering, you know, and then he's able to use that money to invest in lumber and then invest in real estate, becomes wealthy. And we know that there's some people who, they define success as just their own success, right? I made it, and that's all I care about. But this is someone who clearly wanted to use his station in life for the betterment of the entire black race, right? So you think about like the Jim White case where there's a fugitive slave in Muscatine and the Clarks hide Jim White in their home. They get their attorney to represent him in court. You know, when bounty hunters come to try to catch Jim White, Alexander Clark personally rows him across the Mississippi River in the middle of the night, risking his own life and limb. So this is someone who's using his property and using the legal system and using, you know, like his
influence.
Right, his influence and putting his literally his own body on the line.
Yeah.
Right, in order to try to help fugitive slaves, right? You know, someone who during, you know, he's involved in efforts to try to get, you know, the schools integrated before the war, to try to get, you know, black male suffrage, involved in helping to raise the Black Civil War Regiment. I mean, this is, and he could have said, I'm rich and
I'm good.
And I'm rich and I'm good.
Yeah.
Right. But and not perfect. I mean, no one is, right? You know, he's definitely someone who seems to have looked down in some ways on like less, you know, on uneducated, less prosperous Southern blacks. Not in the sense of like, well, they deserve what they get, but in the sense of I'm better than them. And so my job is to try to make them more like me.
Okay.
So there, you know, there's always been this thing in the black community of the talented 10th, right? And people saying, well, you blacks who are, you know, who are less educated, who act more country, in many cases, who are of a darker complexion, like, we need to teach you how to act, right? Mm. We need to, you know, uplift means be more like us. And the answer to that is, why can't I be uplifted but still be who I am, right? And so Alexander Clark definitely seems to have bought into some of that. But, you know, involved in politics. So this is someone who, you know, went to law school eventually. The second—
He came over here, right?
He came here. Yeah. His son is the first black graduate of— not just at the University of Iowa College of Law, but the University of Iowa, period.
Right? Yeah, okay.
And then Clark Sr. is the second. But, you know, using business, using the law, using journalism, using politics, using oratory, using his own home, using his own body, like, you know, whatever, trying all these different things to try to uplift the black race.
Yeah. Clark ended up winning that case, and that's where we have Iowa be the first state in the nation to desegregate its public schools.
The first one after the Civil War. Yeah,
the first one after Civil War. Oh, there were more before Civil War?
There were a few. Okay. There was Massachusetts, for instance. There's a case in 1855, I think, Roberts versus City of Boston.
Okay.
Massachusetts State Supreme Court. It's actually very similar to the Clark case. There's a black girl who lives far from the black school, and she wants to go to her neighborhood school. They turn her away. Her parents sue. Massachusetts State Supreme Court ruled against her. But then a few years later, Massachusetts passes a new law. Their state legislature passes a new law that desegregates the public schools. Mm. But that's before the Clark decision. But yeah, after the war, Iowa was the first state to do that.
Okay.
And one of only a few in the country. I mean, it's, you think about, like, there's multiple instances where when you look at sort of progress, you know, movement towards equality in this country, and you look at what are the first states to do it, it's a couple of states in New England, and then it's Iowa.
Okay.
Right. That's true of school desegregation. That's true of voting rights. And then more recently, that's true with legalizing same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, because Iowa's fifth state in the country, and the first four were, you know, all up in the Northeast. That's part of the heritage there.
That was Dr. B. Stay tuned for part two of our conversation. Thank you for listening to Iowa Civil Rights History Podcast. Until next time, be safe.